listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, and I am here to help you stop counting calories, carbs, and fat grams so you can easily get to a healthy weight and get on with your life. That is my wish for you. I want you to wake up and think about your day, not your diet. If you want to call in and talk with me today, the number is 323-203-0815. That is 323-203-0815. I would love to hear what is on your mind, what is weighing on you. Because the real problem with binge eating, stress eating, or any kind of emotional eating, the real problem is not food. It is what is in your heart and on your mind. I am just going to adjust my little camera for Instagram here. Okay. Okay, so today I want to talk about... I have a couple of things to talk about, and one of the things I wanted to share was an article I did for Psychology Today, and it was about Zoom dysmorphia. And of course, I can't even access my own article, so I might have to leave that for later, because I want to share what I wrote. It's really important to recognize that so many people struggle with kind of a distorted view of themselves. And that is why they asked me to write this article, which you'd think rise to my head. So, you know what? I'm just going to leave it for next week. Okay. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is the link between what goes on with food and what goes on with money. So if I were to describe zoning out, being in a different state of mind, kind of like a strange high, kind of spacing out, going blank, would I be talking about binging or shopping? Well, guess what? The answer is both. Both of those experiences, when people binge and when they shop, when they do some retail therapy, people feel like, oh, no problem, Sharon. I figured you just pressed it by mistake. Sometimes people try to get on my Instagram show by mistake, but I'm glad you're here. So the answer is both. People describe food binges and shopping binges exactly the same way. You're in this zone. So let's talk about retail therapy for a minute. People shop when they're stressed or upset or sad. That's the retail part, because it makes them feel better. That's the therapy part. And the same thing with food. People eat for comfort, people eat to reward, people eat for distraction. It makes them feel better. It takes them away from something that is painful. So there is no question that overeating or, you know, binge eating, stress eating, emotional eating, or overspending are ways of managing uncomfortable, intolerable moods. They're a way of coping. And people tell me all the time, I'm a food addict. I have no willpower. I'm a shopping addict. No, it's not about willpower. It's that you have a way of coping that is actually hurting as well as helping. So let's go a little bit deeper, because both of these behaviors also help you manage emptiness and loneliness. They help you express conflicts over abundance, and they take you away from yourself. And often we get so good at using these behaviors, whether it's, you know, binging or shopping or anything else, that we don't even really know what's going on inside. So how do you figure it out? How do you figure it out? Well, for one thing, what you're buying and how you're buying it can shed some light. So first of all, think about, what is the empty space? Do you buy a lot of the same thing? Maybe you even call yourself a collector. Maybe you're filling a void, symbolically filling a void. Things take up space in our houses, just as food take up space in our stomachs. So both can symbolically fill an empty space inside. So let me tell you about, I'm going to call her Janice. So Janice, I had no idea that Janice had a problem with shopping until she just happened to mention how she kept herself from shopping with the same willpower that she usually reserved for dieting. And Janice told me that she had a weakness for sheets. You know, she said, I have no room in my house for more sheets, but I saw such a pretty set of sheets. I had to have it. I couldn't help myself. They were so pretty and the thread count was high and they were floral and they went with my decor and it was great. I had to have them, had to have them. And I said, well, what do you mean you have no room for sheets? Well, it turned out that she had something like 200 sets of sheets. And that took up a lot of space. Sheets take up a lot of space. They were all over her house in every closet. 200 sets of sheets. So we explored this thing she had about sheets. And she said, you know, it was all about how they looked and how nice and fresh they were and all of that. And it was all of these conscious reasons she had for liking sheets and for being unable to stop herself from buying sheets. But I pressed her for more because, yes, that is what I do. We don't stay on the surface. We go deep. Go deep or go home. And all of a sudden, something popped in her mind. She goes, oh, my gosh, I just remembered. And this is what she remembered. She remembered staying at her friend's house overnight when she was a kid. And there was always, every time she went on a sleepover, there was always a fresh, pretty, clean sheet on the guest bed. And her friend had these great parents who were loving and affectionate and supportive, unlike Janice, who did not have those kinds of parents, not even close. So to Janice, these sheets came to represent the kind of life she wanted, the kind of parents she wanted, the kind of family she wanted. She could not have the happy family, but she could have the sheets. She could have the sheets. And they gave her, temporarily at least, that same happiness that she had when she went over to her friend's house. So, you know, that sense of, oh, I'm being cared for and there's a happy home and all is well. That was sort of one sheet away for her. And I said, Janice, so now we understand. All of these sheets, it's a way of you trying to connect to a loving family. It's a way of you having this sense of fulfillment in a way. And Janice said, because Janice had a sense of humor, Janice said, are you ready? You could probably guess. She said, no sheet. Okay, that totally cracks me up, even when I think about it and when I share it with you. She said, no sheet. Yes. So the good news is, even though, of course, this was a very painful, painful process and subject, she was able to, oh, hold on, caller. I'm gonna just wrap this up and then I'm going to get to you. So once Janice was able to identify what was going on, and once she dealt with her disappointment about not getting the family that she wanted, she stopped buying those sheets. She didn't need them anymore because she was healed. So Ronan is telling me that Josh is on. Hi, Josh. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt what you were doing there with the sheets, but it seemed as though she was unconsciously buying sheets to satisfy something. Is that right?
Yes, buying sheet filled the empty space where she associated it with this happy family and she had this emptiness within because she had quite an unhappy family life. And so buying the sheets gave her a sense of having for a moment that experience of being happy with good parents. But of course it was temporary. So she had to keep buying them and filling them and having more and more and more sheets in the house kind of symbolically filled that space, filled the void.
And that became her identity.
Not her identity, her way of coping with this loss of her way of coping, which she didn't even realize it was about what it was about. All she knew is that she had this compulsion to buy sheets, but it was filling the emptiness, the sense of having a connection to a nice family, but they also filled the literal emptiness. Her house was stuffed with sheets, just as she also often stuffed herself with food. But
okay, so I guess my question was about how that could possibly be tied to the way we see ourselves, like in the mirror, or the way we think people see us, or, you know, I guess body image, say.
I think that have you read my it sounds like you just read my Zoom article, my article on Zoom dysmorphia.
Well, I did read it when it, I guess, yesterday or something.
Yeah, yesterday.
Or 2 days ago. Yeah, yesterday. So, but I can't see the connection. I know, but there has to be a connection.
No, there's not a connection between how she saw herself. That's a totally different topic. So how she, okay. It wasn't about how she saw herself. It was, the reason you can't see a connection is there is no connection. So I was a little scattered this morning. I thought I had my article in front of me and I didn't. So I started to say that I was going to talk about that, but then I ended up talking about this instead. It has nothing to do with her identity or how she saw herself. It had to do with her experience.
Okay. So if someone had an issue in the way they saw themselves, that could also potentially be the reason why one would say buy sheets, even though this is not what the woman was doing.
There's a difference between seeing oneself in a distorted way and experiencing a sense of emptiness within. And those might be tied together, but I would say that using food or things to fill a void is different from seeing yourself in a distorted way. Now,
why do we see ourselves in a distorted way? I think that's what your article is talking about, like why we would do that. Like, what's the psychological reason for seeing oneself not as they actually appear to be, maybe, or as they are?
Well, for example, I talk in the article about the woman who felt ugly every time she somewhere down the line, somewhere early on, and I explain it in the article, she learned that when she felt uncomfortable or angry or upset or hurt, these feelings felt ugly to her, and it translated into her being ugly. She also felt fat. Ugly is not a feeling. Fat is not a feeling, but it's a way of expressing something. You know, it's a way of kind of making sense of how you feel, turning your emotions into something physical. I've shared many times about how when I was a kid, I was always being told I was too much, too loud, too dramatic, too sensitive, too this, too that. And that turned into me literally thinking that I was too much, physically too much. And so there's a connection between
right.
We interpret the messages we get and the experiences that we have. And often that interpretation comes about how we look.
Yeah, so we internalize an aggressive stance by a parent, and now we become the aggressor, like the identification with the aggressor. Now we're the mean person to ourselves and to other people.
Not always to other people. In fact, often I find that with people who struggle with food, treat other people the way they would like to be treated, and they treat themselves as they were treated. And so they're very kind and generous and nice and loving and supportive and amazing to other people, but towards themselves, they can be anything from disinterested to hostile.
Right, and that's almost like masochistic. I mean, it's almost like they're being too nice. And in a sort of a masochistic way.
No. I don't think so. But I wonder if there's something that I can help you with respect to what you are struggling with or what you are contending with, rather than talk about people. Because one thing that I will tell you is I often say I don't. People say, "What's it like to treat eating disorders?" And I say, I do not treat eating disorders. I treat people, and people struggle with eating disorders for reasons that are as unique as they are. And so I don't want to get into a kind of a generalization of people. I'd rather talk about a specific person. And since you are a specific person calling my show, I wonder what's going on with you. How can I help you today?
Okay. So I guess the way you can help me is, we talked about, so like eating a lot in a short amount of time, like kind of, binging because you're eating so fast. And obviously that's my sort of character structure, if you will. It's not under eating, you know,
no.
It's, if anything, it's not, I'm overeating. So
Josh, I gotta interrupt you. That is not your character structure. That is something you learned to do for a reason. And we talked about how eating fast can help you avoid the shame of hunger or yearning. And, because being eating is a sign that you have needs. If you eat really fast, it's like you're quickly taking care of those needs, as opposed to slowing down and recognizing that you're a person with needs for food, for connection, for love, for all kinds of things. So this is not about your character. This is about a coping mechanism that you have created to help you avoid pain, but that also causes pain.
Right. So it was something that I learned to do that was maybe beneficial at the time, if you can even call it that, but probably not.
It's a frenemy. Yeah, it does something for you, but it also hurts you. It's a friend, does something for you in some sense. It also hurts you. So rather than call
would
it
you say that issue, the you would you say the goal is to kind of get to the primary feeling before food was sort of introduced as a crutch, if you will?
I think it's important to recognize what it is doing for you. So in the moment, what is eating fast doing for you? And you very poignantly in a past call talked about it, almost like eating fast was a way of avoiding something just so enormously painful. It seemed intolerable.
Yeah,
what
so like,
is it
if I were to eat because maybe I'm eating because I have a wrong view of my own body. I mean, you said you had a wrong view of your body, and I was thinking that along the same lines, that it sort of corrects an incorrect view of oneself.
But where does it come from? See that, like, we have to go deeper. Yes, if you stay, yes, you have the wrong view of your body. Yes, people who feel ugly or see themselves in a distorted way, literally in a Zoom room or in a mirror, yes, they have a distorted view of their appearance, but where does it come from? What is it expressing? What's getting both expressed and hidden, if you will? So it's digging deeper into the beyond what you discern consciously. It's, well, what else is going on? Why did my patient feel ugly? Why did she feel fat? Why do people feel this way? Why do they see what's sometimes also people say, oh, there's something wrong with me. I have a sense that there's something wrong with me, which is shame. Shame is there's something wrong with me. And so they say, well, right. I'll change this about my appearance. I'll lose weight, or I'll get a nose job, or I'll do something, and then I'll lose the shame. But of course they never do, because shame is not in your body. Shame is in the way that you think about yourself.
Yeah. So it must have been an unbearable conflict. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why one would be in a very hard to handle situation in childhood. I mean, Freud comes to mind, and how he talked about, you know, how the boy has conflicted feelings to both parents, not just the mother.
And Josh, let me ask you something.
Sure.
If you were not eating fast, take a moment and imagine, what would you think and what would you feel? What would you get in touch with that you don't want to get in touch with?
I feel like there's probably, like, as if I'm dirty. Does that make sense?
That's shame. That is, thank you, Josh. That was very raw and vulnerable and real. Yes. The sense that I'm that sense of I'm dirty is shame. Now, what comes to mind when you think of
love? I remember you saying before, you said, I'm worthy of love. I deserve love. And you said, you know, just be silent. And I think that's probably the reason why I don't feel like I do deserve love, because I feel like I'm maybe somehow, whatever the pejorative is, you know, some pejorative. Call it dirty, call it broken, call it, I've heard it. I mean, I'm not the only one to experience this. I know that. So I feel like you could be called any term that you would want, but it's certainly not something that one would have sort of tried to attain to, if you will.
Yes. So what are your associations to that feeling of dirty or broken or whatever it is that you're experiencing? Like, what comes to mind when you think of that?
Well, I think it's probably just maybe not getting the love that one wanted from a parent. I mean, I feel like my father, you know, was maybe not as present as I would have wanted him to be. And if that was something that made me feel, you know, in a negative way, then it's possible that I internalized the feeling of just being slighted by him. And then as a result of that, you know, used food to try to sort of fix the internalized pain.
Exactly. And so kids do not, if you're a boy whose father is not as available or loving to him as he would wish, who feels rejected by his dad in some way, kids do not have the wherewithal to say, wow, I wonder what went on with my dad's, you know, in my dad's life that makes him incapable of relating to his son in an appropriate way. What's with my dad? Kids don't say that.
Right.
Kids say, what's wrong with me that I failed to bring out the loving parent in my father? There must be something wrong with me. When kids don't feel love in that way, they don't feel lovable. And there's the dirty. And then what does food represent? Food represents relationship. So on the one hand, it's, well, there's this emptiness where your father's love should be, but it's not. So we can get filled with food. But there's also that sense of shame over what's wrong with me that my father isn't loving towards me. And that can get turned to what's wrong with me that I can't stop eating? What's wrong with me that I look this way? What's wrong with me? You know, it becomes full on shame, which is something's wrong with me. And so,
it's not our fault. I mean, no one in their right mind goes around blaming infants for feeling negative feelings. Most people go around blaming the parents. And I'm not saying we're trying to blame anyone, but it's certainly not the child's fault. I mean, being mean in this case.
It's no one's fault. We don't want to blame. We want to explain. We want to say, instead of pointing a finger and saying, bad parent. I mean, I would say bad parent if someone was abusive, overtly abusive or something like that, then there's no question that's bad. But often parents just don't know how to parent. You don't get a manual when you have a kid. You parents treat their kids the way they were treated, or, you know, I mean, things get passed down generationally. So it's not about pointing a finger, but it is about explaining. These circumstances early in my life caused me to feel this way about myself. And as a result, I have this relationship with myself and food. And it could be something like, as you know, even my story, which again, I've shared that my family was highly academic. Both of my parents are college professors. And it was like quiet and academic and, you know, serious. And because of that, I was seen as like this wacky child and too loud and too much. Is there anything wrong with being academic and quiet? No. Is there anything wrong with being more spirited? No. It was a misfit in this family. But because there was this misfit, I was seen as too much, and the rest is history. So it's really so important to just look at from a sense of explaining, well, what happened and how did it affect your relationship to yourself and therefore to food? Food represents so much, fills the empty space.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear you say, I think the quote was, I was seen as too much. Do you mean I saw myself as too much, or do you mean someone else saw me as too much, or is there no difference, or should we not worry about a difference?
Well, I was talking about me. I was seen as too much because my very quiet academic parents saw me as too much, but that doesn't mean I was objectively too much. I was too much for them, but not too much. So like there, sometimes it's just a matter of there's a misfit in the family. If your father is incapable of expressing love and being the kind of dad that you wanted and needed, that's not because of a deficit in you, but as a child, of course you would think it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you're right. I mean, we shouldn't blame anyone. I just would want to fix my own brain now. There's nothing I can do about the past, you know, fix not my brain, but my mind, the way I think about things, and to know that while it wasn't my fault, maybe there are some different ways to think about it now as an adult, and to separate it out from what I could do, like buying sheets or eating, that I might be doing, or spending money, or being too, holding on to your money too much, you know, and not spending it, you know? Right? I mean, all of those things, I have to figure out what I'm actually doing.
Yes, and I just want to say one thing, which is that you said you can't do anything about the past, and that is true, but I'm not even talking about the past so much as I'm talking about how does that past affect your present. Earlier in our conversation, you said the way we are treated by other people becomes the way we treat ourselves. In that way, the past is alive in the present. It is haunting your present. And perhaps you are treating yourself as indifferently as your dad treated you. And so what do? You've got to heal the original wound and learn how to give yourself what you wish you would have gotten from him. And that way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah. I just need to love myself. I mean, it's so simple, but it's not simple when you haven't had a good teacher, say, you know?
Yes. The other day I posted in my Facebook group, Dr. Nina's Food for Thought Community. Feel free to join it, anyone who's listening on Facebook. And I posted something about, like, fill in the blank, loving yourself is, and the answers I got were like difficult, impossible. I can't do that. You know, isn't that sad? And that's because, you know, if you don't experience yourself as being loved and therefore lovable, it's really hard to love yourself. So to your point, Josh, saying you love you, that you need to love yourself and how hard that is. And yeah, it is hard. But
yeah,
it's possible to achieve.
I think there's pain in there. You know, I mean, sometimes love is painful. You know, it's like if you're getting a massage and you have a sore spot and you push on it and it hurts, that's sort of the massage. And when you love yourself, there can be sore spots that actually hurt. And you'd be like, why is this so miserable? I'm trying to love myself, but all I'm feeling is pain, you know?
Well, my thought on that is that when you love yourself, you get in touch with how much you never got, with the love you didn't get. Many, many people have told me when they have kids and they look at their kids and they think, how could my parents or this parent or this grandfather or whoever it was, or this sister or whoever it was that was a painful person in their lives, how could this person have treated them when they were that age the way they did? It's almost like it creates an even more intense sense of pain about what happened previously. So loving yourself is not painful, but it can bring up the painful idea of what you never got.
Right. And the idea is not to listen to that, but to just to keep on loving yourself, despite how you were taught how to love yourself by a parent.
Exactly. And to look at, like, you know, to kind of reframe the interpretation, to recognize that this sense of I am dirty, I am lovable, there's something wrong with me, I am broken, I need to be fixed, that this is an idea. This is an interpretation of a kid. We don't just outgrow these ideas. We just take them with us into adulthood. Because here's the thing. When kids are not getting what they need, which is traumatic, little t trauma, they think, well, I'm going to figure out what's wrong with me, and I'm going to figure out what's bad about me, and I'm going to make myself good, which is a strategy for hope. If you could figure out what's wrong with you, you can make yourself right, and then they're going to love you in the way that you want to be loved. This is the hope. This is the illusion, really. But it's that illusion of hope that becomes a conviction that there is something wrong with you when you enter adulthood. It's not like you become an adult and you say, oh, I see it so differently now. No, it just becomes there's something wrong with me.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, it would be nice if a five-year-old boy, meaning me, could have said, Dad, I'd like to talk to you when you get home from work. I have something important on my mind. And, you know, he gets home and you sit down and you look him in the eye and he looks at you and you're 5 years old and you say, well, you know what? I would appreciate if you would pay attention to me more or speak to me in a different way. Thank you very much. And get up and go back to your room at 5 years old. You know, maybe there are some children who can do that. But for most of us, we're just in this web of, we don't even know who we are. We don't even, you know what I mean? It's so blind. It's just, it's an unfortunate situation, but that's childhood. So
Josh, I want you to think about what you, if you did some time traveling, let's say that I found that DeLorean time machine and we went back to you as 5 year old, what would you say to your 5 year old self?
Well, I would say that your parents are loving you as much as they can, and don't identify with the aggressor. Don't become your father in your relationships. Don't become your father to yourself, because obviously that's your go-to. So don't do it.
Okay, that's a good start. You know what I would say if I were with you? I would say, hey, buddy, just because your dad doesn't talk to you doesn't mean you're not lovable. You're a great kid. Any dad would be lucky to have you. You're smart. You're you. You're delightful. And you got to believe that. And just because someone treats you with indifference doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. You are pretty great. That's what I told
right.
that.
Right. And in other words, there's no point to have a distorted image of yourself, and there's no point to use things that you know can't possibly fill a void. It can only get you into this sort of almost more trouble, or certainly not a solution, you know?
So there's no point to doesn't sound very warm and fuzzy. Notice how you're talking to this kid, kind of in a semi-shaming way. There's no point to, no, how yeah. about, yeah, this is hard. I get it. But you know what? You're likable and lovable, and someday you're going to know it. And I want that day to be now, and other people are going to know it too.
Yeah, I really appreciate your sane advice and your sane mind. I'm working on it. I mean, you can probably tell I'm working on it week to week. So hopefully I sound better each week, and I'm just going to keep on, you know, trying to figure out what's actually going on, which is not at all sort of easy.
I want you to come up with a list of qualities about you that existed when you were five and exist for you now about the qualities that you appreciate about you.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I haven't really changed. I feel like I'm kind of the same person I was. It's amazing how we always talk about change, but the reality is none of us really changed I don't know. You can probably tell me more about that than I don't really know what I'm talking about that, but it seems as though we really do kind of stay the same, because why would we be having all of our issues if we really did change, you know, when we become adults? We really don't change. You know, that's why we're having the problems that we're having, in a sense. I mean,
it's changing our relationship to who we are that is important. And maybe who we yeah. are doesn't change, but how we think about who we are does change. So.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. So I just want to say thank you so much for helping me. I'm just so grateful for this opportunity to be able to talk to you like on the phone. I just feel like it's unbelievable opportunity. So thank you so much.
You are very welcome, Josh. Thank you for calling. And I do want you to know that I hear from listeners who talk about the conversations that I have with the people who call in. And I've heard a lot of people say how meaningful your calls have been. And so I want to thank you, because you are helping you, but you're also helping people out there who are listening.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And everyone listening, I really appreciate that. I'm pretty much a genuine person. I don't really say anything that I don't really believe. So this is me. I mean, what you're hearing is who I am. So I appreciate that.
We appreciate you, Josh. I look forward to talking to you when you call next week and see where you are.
Okay. Thanks so much, Dr. Nina. Have a beautiful day.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Oh, Josh. I hear him thinking so hard and working so hard and trying so hard. And I still hear a little bit of, I don't know who his father was or is or what he was like, but I have a sense he was probably kind of stern. Hopefully he can you can exorcise that dad out of your mind. That is really this work. It's a psychological exorcism. Let's get those ideas that you internalized, identified with, those people in your life, that get them out. And Josh, if you're listening, Sharon is saying, Josh, your vulnerability is really helping me. Wishing you well. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I have time to talk about continuing with my discussion of what happens with food and what happens with money can be very similar. The second one is life a struggle? Do you spend your money on all kinds of things? It doesn't matter what, but you often find yourself without enough money, barely scraping by until the next paycheck, and often on the financial edge. Could be you got the message that it's noble to suffer. Having too much registers as greedy, wrong, bad. Maybe staying financially dependent on others gives you a sense of being taken care of, sort of a financial umbilical cord that keeps you connected to other people, usually your family, the ones who are giving you money, and that makes you feel loved. Sometimes the only way that families can express love is through money. Just as food sometimes represents love, so does money. So here's an example. I'm going to call this person Patricia. She was totally overeducated and overqualified for the job she had. She had degrees, but was barely making minimum wage. She was underpaid. She was undervalued. She always wanted to get a better job. And she figured that once she got that job, she would stop living paycheck to paycheck and she wouldn't have to depend on her parents for extra money. By the way, she was, I think, in her early 30s. And then Patricia got a better job. What do you think happened? What do you think happened? Did she open a savings account? Did she contribute to a 401k? Did she breathe a sigh of relief? No, she did not. None of those things happened. She bought expensive clothes, expensive groceries, a more expensive car. She continued to live on the edge, and her parents kept helping her out. So in our work together, she came to realize she stayed dependent on her parents because all they could give her was money. They couldn't deal with anything in her life. They couldn't give her emotional support. Oh my God, no. But they could freely give her financial support. And so if she didn't need their monetary help on some level, she would lose their love. If they weren't giving her a flow of money, it was like that flow of money was a flow of love. And if it wasn't coming in, then she would be empty. Nothing would be coming in. So she felt really guilty for getting herself into a financial mess, and she felt really bad, and she comforted herself with ice cream mostly. And it was hard for her to recognize that she was angry with her parents for being emotionally withholding. She denied that she was mad at them. She would say, oh, they're doing the best they can, or oh, they weren't raised that way, or oh, it's their generation. That generation didn't have emotions. So she denied her anger at their inability to emotionally support her or even have a conversation about how she felt ever. But she got mad at herself for gaining weight and for staying poor instead of expressing her true feelings. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that she needed to express her anger towards her parents. That would probably not be a good idea. It would backfire. None of that would go well. But what she did need to do was admit to herself that she was angry and resentful and sad and work through those feelings. Because having emotionally unsupportive parents is upsetting. She needed to recognize that it was upsetting and work through that. And she had to grieve both what she got and what she didn't get. And that's when she was able to move on. And when she accomplished that, she was better able to accept the limitations of her parents. Guess what she did? I was so proud of her. She went on a budget And it became easier for her to regulate both her spending and her eating. Isn't this, you know, what we hide from ourselves? It still gets expressed somehow. It still comes out somehow. If you're mad at yourself, you know, and especially if you're mad at yourself for what you are eating or how much you weigh, then ask yourself, if you weren't mad at yourself, who or what would you be mad at? Because it's easier to displace that anger onto you and say, God, I can't believe I ate that. Or, oh my God, I'm so disgusting. Or, oh, I got on the scale. And, oh God, I'm so mad at myself. Why did I eat that? It is a lot easier to beat yourself up that way than to say, you know what? There are people and situations in my life that are really upsetting me and I can't change them. I can't change them. I feel helpless. I feel powerless. That powerlessness over other situations and people is so profoundly horrible that we often displace it into a sense of powerlessness over food, which we could, we tell ourselves, control. You know, you can't change the way people are. You could change supposedly how you eat, but it's hard to do that when you're kind of displacing one thing from, you know, something from A to B. So really have compassion for yourself. If you're mad at yourself, maybe there's something else you're mad at and you're not letting yourself feel that way. You know, if you're sad, guess what? You can cope with those sad feelings. You can cope with that vulnerability. You don't need food to do that. You really can process your feelings without food, and feelings don't make you weak. They make you a person. Tears are not a sign of weakness. They are a sign that you are human. Human. So, you know, I have another one about on this subject, which I will go into next week. The last way that you might be using food and shopping the same to resolve something conflicted within you. I will get to that next week. And again, thank you so much. That's our show for today. Thank you so much for joining me here on the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio. You can listen live on LA Talk Radio on Facebook and on Instagram at 11 a.m. Pacific on Wednesdays. You can listen later on Apple Podcasts. Just do a search for the Dr. Nina Show on LA Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get podcasts. And if you love the show, please take a moment and write a review or even just leave a rating. It would mean so much to me, because the more reviews and the more ratings I get, the more people I reach, the more people that we can help. Just one quick question from Sharon on Instagram. When you're feeling helpless, what would be some examples of vary that would be helpful? Sharon, since I'm out of time, I'm going to get to that next week, but you know what? I'll do it now. Really quickly, I would say, yes, I feel helpless. This is upsetting. I feel helpless. I feel angry and sad and whatever it is that gets associated with helplessness. Of course I do. Anyone in my position would feel this way. It is a profoundly horrible feeling to feel this way. Of course I feel this way. That's the validate and acknowledge. And then you reassure yourself by saying, there are other areas in my life that I do have a sense of agency over. There are other areas in my life where I feel powerful, or at least where I am not powerless. And I'm going to focus on that and remember, too, that this will pass. I will not always feel this way. It's just what I feel now. And I'm going to look back at other times when I felt this way and I got past it and I was okay. And so by acknowledging the awfulness of it, by validating the awfulness of it, by reassuring yourself instead of dismissing it and telling yourself why you shouldn't feel it, that really does help. I hope that helps. Sharon, thank you for that question. Everyone, I will see you next week. Same time, same place. and stay curious, not critical this week. Bye for now.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.